this topic for tonight about the nutriment. This is a theme that I have been wanting to develop for some time and will be developing further during the upcoming rains retreat. Possibly later on I'll be working it into a retreat, a Zoom retreat. You all will have the privilege of getting the first draft of my reflection. So if it's incoherent or confused, it's because it's the first draft. On the other hand, this talk will be more spontaneous than the one that I might give later on after I've given the same talk five or six different times. The topic tonight is about using the requisites of life without being overtaken by greed or aversion. The requisites of life are the things that we need to have in order to live. For the monastic, there's the requisite of the food, the clothing, the shelter, and the medicine. On a more general sense, there's a very profound teaching about nutriment. The Pali word is ahara. And the Buddha starts with this simple observation. All living beings subsist on nutriment. That's a foundational truth. Even if you look around the world, you can't find any animal anywhere, or any fish or insect or breathing, living creature in the animal kingdom who doesn't take in food. They take in oxygen and air. They take in food. They use those chemicals and then they expel the leftover. Even the plant life requires organic material in order to exist. So if you looked over the entire world, this earth that we live on, you would hardly find a single plant or animal that doesn't actually take the leftover from the other form of life. So life is consuming life. The cow is consuming the grass and then pooping on the grass, and then the grass uses the fertilizer from the cow in order to grow in this cycle of life. I heard that there is some kind of a worm-like living creature that exists in the thermal vents at the bottom of the ocean that is able to directly process the chemicals that are coming out from within the bowels of the earth and is not subsisting on another living creature. But that's the only living thing that I know about. All the other ones are just in this endless circle of life-consuming life. So in one level, that's beautiful. And then on another level, it's quite stressful, isn't it? The fundamental definition of dukkha includes the suffering of the round that we are obliged to do the work to keep our life going. And we are born with the equipment and the drive that drives us to want to keep on going on and on, and then through the cycle of birth and rebirth, if we don't get out of it, we can continue going on forever from one life to another. One could start by just considering the nutriment of the physical body by way of food or the things that we put into the body. Most of the time when we're eating, we might be aware of the hunger or the desire for food, or we might be aware of the pleasure and enjoyment of food. We could be aware that by the type of food that we choose to eat and to serve, that we're making some kind of a statement about ourselves. So we're the type of person who's a vegetarian, who likes Sri Lankan food or likes Thai food or likes some different kinds of food. So the food becomes a style statement about our identity, or the food could be an opportunity to socialize, to be in a communion with our families and those when we sit around the table and eat together. All of those things are happening, but the reflection that is invited here is to just acknowledge the body needs the food, and a lot of our drive and feelings is coming from that. If we run out of food, if we didn't have anything to eat, then there could be a lot of anxiety, a lot of restlessness. We could be pacing up and down or seeking and looking to find something to eat if we didn't have anything to eat. Or there could be a lot of sorrow if there was actually not enough food to eat. Every year on this planet, more than 6 million people die because of hunger or malnutrition. And so those people had the chance to experience the deep dukkha of, it's like what the kind of equipment, like what we got as a human, is we want to take care of our life. And then to be unable to do that is really taking you to the face-to-face with the fundamentals of the suffering of that's a potential in our particular kind of existence, being the type of animal who's made out of flesh and meat and that is living on food. The Buddha identifies four different kinds of nutriments, and those are defined as being the nutriments for the support of beings who have come into existence and for assistance of beings seeking a new existence. So he extended this basic observation about food and nutriment to see how it applies to the cycle of birth and death. The first is the edible food, as we were describing, which is necessary for the support of the living body. Our existence depends on having a living body. The mind or the mental factors is existing in a contact, in a relationship with a living body. The second, I'm going to explain the four, and then I'm going to speak about how to work with them in order to take care of the nutriments without greed and aversion. But the Buddha said, I'm going to tell you, he said, there's one topic This must have been in the Book of Ones in the Anguttara Nikaya. The Buddha always says, there's one thing, O monks. Which, when thoroughly examined and well understood, will lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, and to enlightenment. And that one thing is, all beings depend on nutriment. So if we work with this properly, not only can we get out of the obvious turmoil of like and dislike, but we can use this practice to take us towards the goal for which the Buddha has come into the world and taught us. So the first nutriment is edible food for the body. The second one is called in English contact, or in Pali it's called pasa. I'm not allowed to write to everybody. So it's called pasa, P-H-A-S-S-A. That means contact. Literally, pasa is referring to the touch, like the sensations that happen when the body is touching. But the Buddha extends it, including like the touch of the ear with the vibration of sound, with the eye, with the visible object, and so on. So all of these are called pasa, or touch. And the touching of the mind with its object. So this is where like mentality and materiality is coming together. It's said that there's what's called a triple conjunction. There's a kind of object, which could be like a sound, a visible object, or a smell, or a taste. And then there's a corresponding sense faculty and a corresponding type of consciousness, which is able to know that object. You could think of the sense faculty as functioning like a door. So the consciousness comes to the door to meet the object. And then the object comes to the door to meet the consciousness. And they meet right there. It's said in dependent origination, dependent on contact comes feeling. So contact is the nutriment for feeling. And feeling is the powerful nutriment for craving. And so by the time feeling arises, we're almost ready to be off to the races, going around and around in the cycle of craving and clinging and proliferating and everything else. You could say that the whole group of the mentality is arising depending on contact. So there's the contact, and then comes the feeling, the perception, the volitional formations, and the consciousness itself. All of those things are arising moment by moment, independence on that contact. Another statement elsewhere in the suttas, it says that perception depends on contact. So from contact comes feeling, from contact comes perception. The feeling is determining the affect. You like it. If you like it, you want it, you're going to get some. You want to keep it. You want to hold it. Or if the feeling is negative, you want to push it away or run away or kill it. So that's the what's coming as a result of the affect. And then the perception is the domain of our ideas, our understanding, how we understand and interpret the world. So all of those things are nourished by contact. Now, I'm going to come back to this later and how to work with it. The next kind of nutriment, the third kind of nutriment, is called mental volition. It's called mano sanchetana. So sanchetana means volition. And, well, it's happening in the mind. So it's mano sanchetana. These are the mental activities that determine karma. So what you intend becomes your karma. I said it earlier on that the nutriments are related to continuing one's existence, and they're also related to assisting a being who's seeking a new existence. So the karma is contributing to the next moment that you're going to have in this life, what kind of experience you will have, whether it will be beautiful or horrible, is conditioned by the karma that you create, and also the next life that you come to. What this individual is seeking is dependent on what kind of karma you make. The karma that you make is leading you to be reborn in some realm of existence, either the realm of desire, which would be like as a hungry ghost or an animal or somebody suffering in hell or a human being or an angel or a god in the lower realms of the gods. All of those are connected with the world of desire. If we are living like animals, we could get to be reborn as animals. If we allow ourselves to be overtaken with, dominated by unwholesome, cruel, negative volitions, we could be reborn in a painful state. Or if we are practicing generosity and making merits and doing good things and helping people, or if we're practicing kinds of meditation that are below the level of jhana, like reflecting on the qualities of the triple gem, or practicing loving kindness, not at the jhana level, but at the discursive level. All of those merits are giving us a heavenly life in this existence, and also leading us to be reborn in a heavenly realm. If we practice jhana, that's considered a fine material type of meditation, and that could lead us to be reborn in what's called a fine material realm of existence. And if we are able to practice the immaterial meditations, like the contemplation on infinite space, contemplation of infinite consciousness, and so forth, then we're still making karma, and we could get reborn in that immaterial realm. All of this is still keeping us on going around and around on the same merry-go-round. So, again, we'll come back to it later, but it's better to be aiming for a heavenly existence than to aim for hell. So definitely doing wholesome deeds is going part of the way towards having the space and the opportunity for the arising of wisdom and the possibility of cutting this cycle. But if you don't cut the cycle, you're nourishing the round of rebirth while you do the karmas arising from this mano sanchetana, this mental volition. Then the fourth nutriment is called consciousness or vijnana. Here, the explanations that I've seen are can be it gets a little bit technical, I think. So it is said that consciousness is the nutriment for name and form are what's called mentality and materiality. So this is the aspect of the dependent origination teaching, which is about how a sentient being gets to be born and to come into existence. So according to the Buddhist theory, as long as there's a living being, there is some level of consciousness operating. So even if I get knocked out and I'm unconscious because of illness, or if I'm in a deep dreamless sleep, nevertheless, in Buddhism, it's considered that there is some kind of a consciousness present. And then the when the consciousness goes away, that's the moment of death of this particular individual. So the consciousness has left from the body, and then this individual doesn't live anymore. In the Buddhist idea of birth, if because of karma, that consciousness is still got that attachment, clinging, and craving as a factor, then that consciousness will be seeking for a different body, and it would find a fertilized egg within the womb of a body, or it would find, if it's not the type of being that's born from an egg, like if it's an angel or something, it would go into that other being, and so then there would come to be this renewed existence. So you can't have consciousness without mentality and materiality. That's a living body and a mind. And you can't have a living body mind without the consciousness. So the two things are dependent on each other, like two stacks of hay. I find this explanation, it's okay. It's clear enough as it goes, as a metaphor. But I also feel separately from this about quite a bit. And I'm aware that there's something that existed both in Buddhism and in the other meditative traditions outside of Buddhism during his time, in the like in the Upanishads and so forth. And they had the idea that there is a consciousness which is pure, timeless, blissful, unchanging. Different schools had different ideas about how it connects with karma or doesn't connect with karma. Either it's apart from karma or it's part of karma. But that they definitely had the idea that this consciousness is the thing that goes on from life to life. And my idea is that this pure consciousness, something that modern philosophers call witness consciousness, is something that can be experienced. So when you encounter an object and you have the experience of meeting that object and knowing here's this object coming into your experience, you also are able to have a kind of a reflective awareness of your own knowing faculty, your own consciousness. And it's possible in certain kinds of meditation to gradually like drop out being involved with the objects until one is just aware of, I guess in Buddhism, it's sometimes called the pure citta, just being aware of the mind and without necessarily being aware, like in contact or connection with the objects. And in other schools, they called this consciousness. And to me, this consciousness is the most subtle kind of a delusion, because it's something that's private. I am the only person who's able to experience my consciousness. Nobody else can directly experience that except me. So it becomes something that's mine. And that experience, if you can get there in meditation to experience that pure citta or that pure witness consciousness, it's a really blissful, pure kind of meditation. And people imagine that they're enlightened, that they're in heaven, or that they're going to meet God, or whatever they think when they get to those experiences. And because of how it's experienced, people imagine this is like the highest, purest, most wonderful essence of the self. And if you think that way, then you have what's called an acquisition. You have acquired this idea that this is me, this is myself, this is the innermost, highest self. And if you make that into an acquisition, that's what takes you on to the next birth. It's because you're clinging to it, because you have an attachment to consciousness. So it's the last attachment. Even after I don't identify with my car, I don't identify with my bicycle, I don't identify with my body, I don't identify with the seeing faculty or the hearing faculty, which are not as good as they used to be anymore. I don't identify with those things. I don't identify with my emotions, but then I may still identify with that pure consciousness. So it's the last hangout for this self-identity. And it's because of that, in my belief. That's why consciousness is the nutriment for the being who's going to come to another state of existence. So that's my belief about that. I think I'm going to talk about ways to work with these things, but I think I'm going to pause and see if anybody has a question. I might take one question or two questions if anybody's confused about what I've tried to say so far. And if it's clear, I'll go ahead and tell you how to work with it. Seems like we're good. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and how can we practice for disenchantment and dispassion towards these four nutriments? So regarding edible food, the monks have very specific guidelines about fasting for part of the day and just taking the food that's offered, not being selective about the food. People in lay life also may have good guidelines that you follow, like choosing a nutritious food, choosing food that's not imposing too much cruelty and harm on the environment, taking healthy food. We do the contemplation before taking food, wisely reflecting. We use the sans food, not for fun, not for pleasure, not for building up the body, not for beautification, only for the maintenance and nourishment of this body, to keep the life going on so that we can continue to practice and make the effort towards our highest aspiration, our highest goals. So doing that kind of reflection, being restrained, knowing the measure of food, not overeating. We notice this is what happens a lot with monastics because we don't control how much food we get, even poor people or people in a primitive culture. They may not get very much food for a long time, and then from time to time, you know, somebody's killed a deer, and so you've got a lot of food. And so when there's a lot of food, there's a temptation to just take a lot because you may not have a lot tomorrow. So the training is, you know, just take enough. Just take the right amount of food for right now. Don't eat because of anxiety about tomorrow. If you will note the flavor of the food, if the food is tasty, you can notice liking the food. And by being mindful and aware of liking, then the liking doesn't take the upper hand and get in control of your mind. So by practicing mindfulness, then you're not letting these patterns run off on their own. Another aspect, like while on retreat, you could eat very slowly. Notice looking at the food, choosing which bite you're going to take next, picking up the chopsticks or the spoon, lifting it, lifting, 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 put it in the mouth, noticing each time you chew, notice the saliva, notice intending to swallow. And when you notice the process of food, this normally it happens, you're not aware of it. But if you bring it all into awareness, that also can lead to a disenchantment with the act of eating. So that, like, the mindfulness of the body in the process of eating is a protection against being overtaken with like and dislike in relationship to food. And we see the pleasure in food. This is when we were humans. We were born with minds that, you know, starts to salivate and starts to feel happy when we see that there's some food coming. So we notice the pleasure. We notice, and then we notice the danger because it's impermanent. And it's dangerous if we eat too much. And then we notice the cessation like that. Then this next one, which is this contact, which gives rise to feeling, which gives rise to the whole process of life, which is driven by feeling, by pleasant and unpleasant. The practice of the Vedana Nupassana, the mindful contemplation of feeling, is the best protection of not being overtaken by contact and its result. When we give mindful attention to every passing moment, we don't focus all our attention on what's really pleasant, and we don't put all our attention on what's really unpleasant, but we give each moment an equal share of attention. And we see that there are many, many neutral moments in between the pleasant and unpleasant ones. And we give an equal-minded amount of attention to each moment. And that gives us spaciousness and freedom. Because when we experience something pleasant or unpleasant, it doesn't dominate the mind because we see there's so many neutral moments in between them. And then... we can see that there's some suffering inherent even in a pleasant feeling because it's impermanent. We can see that the painful feeling also has a big danger that we'll be pulled into all kinds of further karmas because of that, that will perpetuate the painful feeling. We can see that a neutral feeling can lead to a subtle kind of grasping because it seems to be stable. And so we can imagine if we're in a very neutral state, we can think we've accomplished something permanent, but it's not permanent. Regarding volition, mental volition or creating karmas, first start by making merits and suffusing the mind with joy, and using your meritorious, good, skillful deeds to suppress and weaken the unskillful volitions. In meditation, like generating the Brahma-viharas, is a kind of a skillful act of the mind. And then from that kind of skillful volition, then you can move on towards different kind of volition, which is on the way to the awakening factors. So if you know that factors of awakening, like mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, energy, bliss, tranquility, concentration, equanimity. You've learned what these factors are and learned how to recognize them. And so you're directing your intention to support these factors because you have confidence in the teachings that these are the factors that can lead you to this dispassion and this letting go. And then regarding the consciousness, main thing, I think I implied this at the beginning, is if you will just notice the identification or the acquisition of a self with the consciousness, with that knowing faculty, and try to notice that clearly. If you want to be able to see the mind, and it's a little difficult to visualize it, noticing the states of mind, like the mind is affected by anger, or the mind is affected by greed, or the mind is expansive, or the mind is contracted, noticing the states of mind is helping to point the awareness that way. I listened to a talk by Bhikkhu Bodhi just before this on this topic, and he said just using the word mind while he's doing cittanupassana, the contemplation of mind, he just would like quietly say mind, and when he says mind, it makes the mind turn towards the mind. So learn how to watch the mind. So this is what I have to say, and I think the timing is pretty good because I think there's 7 minutes left in your program. So there's might be time for a question or a couple of questions, as well as having our closing. Okay. I see Mary Page.
Would you go over the third one again quickly? I went by so quick I didn't get a chance to really understand it.
Okay.
What to do.
The third, it's edible food contact. And then the third one is the mental volitions.
Right.
So first, develop wholesome mental volitions, good intentions, as a way to depress the bad intentions. And then when you become stabilized in your good intentions, then think about intentions that are leading to awakening, such as intending to develop the factors of awakening.
Okay.
It's great. Like the Buddha said that in conversation, he has a conversation intending to end the conversation. So he doesn't want to go on and on forever. He talks with an inclination to the conversation to be over. So you're doing intentional things with the intention for the intention to be over.